3. The Temple, City of Zion, the Temple Lands. Silent snowflakes battered against the floor-to-ceiling windows like lost ghosts. The brilliant mystic lighting, which always illuminated the outside of the temple, turned the swirling flakes into glittering gems until the wind caught them and swept them to their rendezvous with the window. Howard Wilson watched them changing from gorgeous jewels into feathery ghosts and felt a coldness, far deeper than that of the night beyond the windows, whispering in the marrow of his bones. He looked away from the transmuting snowflakes at the luxurious suite assigned to his brother. Every vicar had personal apartments in the enormous, majestic sweep of the temple, and as apartments went, Samuel Wilson's were not particularly huge. They weren't tiny, either, yet they were substantially more modest than a vicar of Samuel's seniority might have demanded. They were more plainly and simply furnished, too, without the sumptuous luxury other vicars required. Jaspar Clinton, the current Grand Inquisitor, was a case in point. It was rumored, almost certainly correctly, that the art treasures in his chambers alone were probably worth the total annual income of most baronies. And that didn't even consider the fact that Clinton had demanded and received one of the coveted corner apartments, with windows looking both east and north, allowing him to survey the roofs, towers, and buildings of the City of Zion through one set, and the magnificent dome and colonnade of the main temple through the other. Howard supposed that one could make the argument, as Clinton obviously did, that such quarters were merely in keeping with the office of the man responsible for overseeing the state of Mother Church's soul. More than once he'd heard Clinton piously declaiming about the need to properly support the authority and prestige of the Grand Inquisitor, of the need to emphasize the necessary, always necessary, extent of that official's authority over all of Mother Church's children in ways which even the most worldly soul might recognize. To reach out to those too easily impressed by the trappings and power of this world in ways which even they could not ignore. It was never about his own gluttonous, greedy, debauched, power-mongering personal lifestyle or desires. Oh, Langhorne, no! Howard felt his lips tightening and acid churned in his stomach as he compared his brother's chosen simplicity, the absence of statuary, the dearth of priceless carpets, the lack of stupendous oil paintings by the greatest master's safehold had ever produced, with Clinton's. There were paintings on Samuel's walls, but they were portraits of both his first and his current wife, his three sons, his two daughters, his son-in-law, and his first grandchild. The furniture was comfortable and certainly not cheap, yet it was only furniture, selected because it was comfortable and not to emphasize the importance of its owner. And the artworks which adorned his bookshelves and prayer desk were modest and understated, almost all exquisitely wrought, but most of them by lesser-known artists he had chosen to support with his patronage, because something about the pieces had touched his own heart, his own soul and faith. If Samuel had only won the election, Howard thought bitterly, he came so close. In fact, I'm still not convinced Clinton really won. That lickspittle Reno was in charge of the vote count after all, and look where he wound up. Of course, if Samuel had won, if he'd become the new Grand Inquisitor instead of Clinton, the vast gulf between the fashion in which he would have furnished his apartments in the temple and the fashion in which Clinton had done the same thing would have been the least of Mother Church's differences. For one thing, this damned schism would never have happened. Samuel would never have signed off on Clinton's casual proposal to completely destroy an entire kingdom just because it had pissed him off. For that matter, Clinton wouldn't have been in any position to be tossing off suggestions like that in the first place. Of course, Howard admitted grimly, it's probably at least as likely that if he'd won, he would have been assassinated by now. It's happened to more than one of our ancestors, after all. So at least we were spared that much. Not that it's going to make any difference in the end. He drew a deep breath, and his hard eyes softened as he glanced at his brother. He and Samuel had always been close, despite the almost 10 years between their ages. He'd always admired Samuel, always known Samuel was fated to do great things for God and Mother Church. He knew his mother had been dismayed when Samuel chose the Schulerites. She might not have been a Wilson by birth, but she'd scarcely been blind to the way in which the heritage of the family into which she had married had pitted so many of its members against church corruption over the last 3 or 4 centuries. She'd understood what had drawn Samuel into the Order of Schuler, recognized his burning desire to do something to fight the evils he saw gathering about the temple. And she'd remembered what had happened to his great-grandfather just over 100 years ago now. Saint Everihard's grand vicarate had been the shortest in history, and whatever the official histories might say, no one ever doubted that his accidental fall had been the direct result of his efforts to reform the vicarate. And the grand vicarate of Grand Vicar Terrell, Samuel and Howard's granduncle, had been almost as short. There were no rumors to suggest Terrell's death had been arranged, but he'd been old and in ill health when he'd been raised to Langhorne's throne, without the vigor and energy which had characterized Everihard. His fellow vicars may have felt they could simply wait for natural causes to put an end to his reform efforts. Of course, it was also always possible the natural causes which had finally killed him had been nudged along just a bit, despite what anyone might have thought.